From National Public Radio in Washington, this is Options.
I have often wished in the last 10 years, as our troubles intensify, our bewilderment mounts, and diagnosis and prognosis grow more frenzied, that I could receive a special dispensation to come back 100 or 500 years hence, just for a day in the library to find out how historians of the future will classify our time.
On today's Options, we have a general theme: history, the presidency, bureaucracy. Our first feature is Pulitzer Prize-winning author Barbara Tuchman. She is probably best known for her work The Guns of August, a book about World War I. Right now, we are in the midst of a speech she gave at the University of California at Berkeley. Her talk is entitled, How Will History Judge Us?
The first half of the 20th century has already been designated by the Cambridge Modern History as the Age of Violence. We cannot yet tell whether the second half will be known as the age that ruined the earth or that walked on the moon. To find clues to the answer, the best way, I think, is to stand off and gain some perspective on ourselves by examining human experience in an earlier age of adversity. The process is more useful and certainly more entertaining than the current myopic obsession with the present. It discloses startling parallels which allow one to gain insights into what is persistent in the human race and what is not. Though we may fly and talk to each other through the air and light up the night, we're not very different in essentials from our ancestors who could do none of these things. For mankind, said Dryden, is ever the same and nothing lost out of nature, though everything is altered. People of the 14th century were as conscious as we are that human conduct was wrecking society. Yet despite the earnest endeavor of kings, prelates, universities, in many councils and parleys and sermons, they could neither end the war nor heal the schism, though they genuinely wanted to do both. The one dragged on intermittently for 113 years, the other for 50. What shall befall hereafterward, wrote John Gower despairingly in 1393. God wot. For now upon this tide, men see the world on every side, in sundry wise so diversed that it well nigh stand all reversed. This ebb tide lasted for about 200 years, roughly from 1300 to 1500. These are dates of convenience, which some of you will instantly dispute, but never mind. Regardless of when the Renaissance began, and you may take the invention of printing in 1465 or the discovery of America in 1492 as signals, the world entered a dynamic new period, which may be said, with halts and ups and downs, to have lasted about 400 years. It reached a climax in the accelerated burst of the industrial age, coinciding with the extended 19th century, which I think you might stretch from the French Revolution or the steam engine to 1914. Then begins our time. Another disintegration, another 4th or 14th century, the terrible 20th. Which is not to say that the machine age stopped, for the ends of eras do not tie off neatly everywhere at once. On the contrary, technology has exploded, but whether the effect of nuclear energy, computers, television, and so forth, with all their implications, has been more beneficial than harmful is now, of course, disputed. Either way, it is clear that 1914 marked the end of an age of optimism, of tremendous confidence, of belief in progress and the perfectibility of man. It has been succeeded by an age of doubt, a sense of human helplessness in the face of runaway events that seem beyond our power to control, and a sense of dismay at the brute within us that still springs forth, not in the least tamed by the centuries. In the place of the splendid Victorian of Henley's image, claiming to be master of his fate, and captain of his soul. Our image is the anti-hero, a tramp sitting in a ditch waiting for Godot. Or you can choose Ionescu's image of the human species turning itself one by one into that large pig with a horn called rhinoceros. The artist can sometimes say more than the historian. While I cannot speak for their authors, those two plays represent, I think, the artist's version of that sense of futility, absurdity, even disgust that pervades man's view of himself in the 20th century. And doubt and disgust raise no cathedrals. Self-respect, or the absence thereof, is the key to the judgment of future historians, for they may modify, but will not essentially alter our own estimate. In the great ages, the dynamic ages, men see themselves as but a little lower than the angels. They are filled with a sense of infinite capacity. They are prepared to kill giants like David, or conquer the world like Alexander, summarize knowledge like Aquinas, or sail the endless loneliness of the uncharted seas, severed from any connection with home. The hero of Greek tragedy is noble. That is the essence of his tragedy. Ours is in the death of a salesman. We see man as victim, and small, without grandeur or pride. Whereas even slaves, sculptured by Michelangelo, struggling against their bonds, have an indomitable quality no artist today could duplicate because he would not feel it. Ours is an age, judging by its literature, that sees man as the prey of his weaknesses and, on the whole, rather nasty. Our writers write out of dislike of their species, whom they generally represent as absorbed 19 hours a day in repetitive varieties of sex and sadism. The result is, I think, a stunted version of the humankind, for these are not the only concerns that drive us, that moved Mozart, let us say, to compose his music, or Washington to hold on to the desperate winter of Valley Forge. The Middle Ages knew better. They did not consider sex the primary engine. In their rank of sins, and sin meant to them, the worldly drives that diverted men from the quest for salvation, they put vainglory and avarice, that is, the lusts for power, glory, money, even for knowledge and beauty, first. Lechery was just one among others. In the tormented 14th century, however, as now, the dominant tone was self-disparagement, plus nostalgia for that golden past, which always seems to have been so much better conducted. Pistache Deschamps, the court poet of France, scolded and scorned his contemporaries for the greed of knights, the simony of clerics, the idleness and ignorance of the poor, the damnation of war, the fraud of merchants, the quarrels of Italians, the silliness of fashions, the iniquity of lawyers. Formerly, he wrote, knights of old and their children went to mass, believed in God, lived each on his own. The common people labored in simplicity, each content with his own place. Religion then was a bond for all, but today vice reigns only. That's a familiar ring. The 14th century was struggling and suffering without advancing, waiting for a spiritual renewal that did not come, and tormented by a general unrest amounting, in the words of Henri Pirenne, almost to mental confusion. Among its rulers, it had no great men, he adds, but only, quote, personalities of the second class, a fact that usually accompanies an age of decline. Nor were the rulers always notable for high ethical standards. They lied then, too. At a time when the Pope was trying to arrange peace, he discovered that King Edward of England, while ostensibly dealing with the King of France, was secretly negotiating behind his back with France's treacherous vassal, the King of Navarre. Rebuked by the Pope, Edward denied the charge in writing on his, quote, oath as a king, although the tape, text of his, of his treaty with Navarre exists. Some years later, the corruptions, mismanagement, and abuse of power by the ministers of this same King Edward caused the so-called Good Parliament of 1376 to invent the process of impeachment and to carry it through to trial and conviction of the king's ministers. But since the monarchy, when supported by the major nobility, still had the upper hand, the dismissed ministers were back in office within a year. I hope this is not a parallel. History has its comforts. The 14th century, being nearer to God, ascribed its afflictions to divine punishment for their sins. And here is no parallel, I think, but a fundamental difference with our time. Medieval people lived intimately with a sense of sin because its inculcation was essential to the maintenance of Christian doctrine. We, on the other hand, are trying to do without it. We have shed personal responsibility for wrong. Murderers and muggers are considered victims of society. Higher placed lawbreakers are excused as merely overzealous. A sense of sin, that is, the recognition of wrong, has been silently dwindling over recent decades, like the whooping crane or other endangered species, until suddenly its absence, when revealed in the upper reaches of government, comes into startling visibility. No amount of police, courts, and prisons can make society's controls work if the individual conscience is inoperative. A concept of sin did not... A concept of sin did not help the 14th century behave any better than we do, because at the same time it was critically aware of the failure and rot of its institutions. Public opinion then was turning against the two primary estates of clergy and nobles for abusing or failing to perform the functions assigned to them in the medieval order. The priest was supposed to pray for human society, the knight to defend it, and the third estate to do its work. But a corrupt clergy offered uncertain salvation, while lords and knights, far from defending the common people, oppressed them worse than did the enemy. The system was breaking down. Today, this phenomenon is so familiar, it has been given a name, if I can say it, deinstitutionalization, which means, I take it, what happens when institutions hitherto taken for granted either fail or betray us. Marriage, the hometown, the presidency, the army, manners and morals, and a normal premise of obedience to rules crumble under our feet. When the certainties go and the framework comes apart, whether in the 14th or the 20th century, people are left loose, which is uncomfortable. Some become alienated. Some seek an explanation for the malignance and capriciousness of events in demonology and the occult. Many of the young welcome the collapse of old standards as liberation from what they consider false values. But to be liberated is often to be lost, which perhaps accounts for the sadness often seen in the eyes of the young. Alas, mourned the great troubadour Walter von der Vogelweider, how miserably thrive the young folk whose minds once felt no room. In these days they know naught but care. Alas, why go they thus? Whithersoever I turn in the world, no man is merry. Dancing, singing are all perished for sorrow. Never saw Christian folk so wretched a year. The world on all sides is full of ungrace. Actually, that dirge was written not in the 14th century, but in 1227. At the full tide, not the ebb, which only confirms the one sure rule of history that no one period is all one thing at one time. Historical periods, like the men who live in them, are full of variables and contrary trends. The court of Charlemagne blazed like a brief torch in the surrounding gloom of the Dark Ages. And who is to say what is the dominant trend today? Preservation of the environment or its destruction? The truth of an age is never quite to be grasped. Forever in pursuit, forever eluded, like the lover on the Grecian urn, the historian can never be sure that he knows what the past was really like. And no doubt the same difficulty will afflict the future historian who looks back on us. The chief hazard is the temptation to find in a given period what one is looking for and use it to prove a thesis. Every decade now has its ideological revisionists scurrying over the terrain, not in search of how it really was, but how it can be made to fit their dogma. These are the blue light historians, a term I borrow from the haberdasher who called to his assistant, "Hey, George, the gentleman wants a blue suit. Turn on the blue light." What is persistent in human behavior needs no artificial light to reveal it. The Hundred Years' War, despite long periods of truce, was ruinously expensive, piling up costs unheard of before, and necessitating year after year of extraordinary taxes and spreading civil strife at home. When the taxes failed to bring in enough money to keep men in arms for extended periods, the kings resorted to debasement of coinage, defrauding the public. Brutality became endemic. During truces, when soldiers were released to avoid the necessity of paying them, they formed mercenary marauding bands called free companies, which became the scourge of Europe. They wrecked and ravaged the countryside, pillaging, burning, killing, torturing peasants for a hidden store of grain, holding cities to ransom for gold. Impossible to contain or control, they represented armed force gone wild. Not unlike our respectable Army Engineer Corps as it sweeps over the country, bulldozing human habitation and nature's arrangements impartially, with the same medieval recklessness of result. If our time is touched with lunacy, it is not the first time. Adversity rendered the 14th century slightly crazy, in the opinion of Jules Michelet, whom some think France's greatest historian. His verdict on the 14th century was, and I quote, "If wisdom consists in self-knowledge and peace of mind, no epoch was more naturally mad." He spoke too soon. What of an epoch that keeps adding highways and abandoning railroads when enlightened self-interest dictates the reverse? What of a people who use dwindling fuel to heat buildings in winter to 80 degrees because 60 is too cold, and cool them in summer to 60 degrees because 80 is too hot? Got another punchline here. Which was, "Michelet, thou shouldst be living at this hour." Our age must cope, of course, with two new elements not present in the Middle Ages: overpopulation with its consequence pollution, and the capacity to annihilate ourselves by the bomb. As to the first, it appears that the birth rate in the developed countries is tending to stabilize, while in the undeveloped countries it is not. There, the Malthusian tragedy has already started, though it is unlikely to produce revolutionary explosion. For starvation, real starvation, drains the energy and anger necessary for outbreak. Its victims just come to a drooping standstill and die. Meanwhile, in the West, we have the means and the knowledge to control pollution, but not the will nor the recognition of self-interest. These are blocked by short-term greed, that old primary sin of avarice, and will not prevail until America finds some value other than growth and profits. just for encouragement, let me read you an ordinance of Charles VI in 1404, ordering penalties for throwing refuse into the river. "The Seine," stated the king, "is so full of dung, rubbish, ordure, putrefaction, and garbage that it is a great horror and abomination to see, and a great marvel that human beings using the water do not suffer incurable sickness and death. Judging by 3 such ordinances in 4 years, people then, too, could not be made to worry about engulfment by garbage until it climbed up the riverbank to their doorsteps. As to the bomb, I do not think it will go off for the same reason that poison gas was not used a second time. It blows back. The bomb's effect cannot be confined to the enemy. Besides, people tend to think of the bomb as total, whereas nothing in history is total. If the bomb should go off, many would die, and many, regardless of all those statistics on overkill, would survive and start over again, which might be interesting. What would we make of a second chance? The 14th century was not devoid of contribution. Looking back, we can see a historic movement taking shape in the sentiment of nationalism, soon to become the active organizing principle of the modern world. It grew out of the mutual hostility generated by the Hundred Years' War. The French became more French in resisting the invading English, whom they grew to hate for their brutality and robbery and very presence in conquered areas. Equally, the English came to hate the French for frustrating their grasp at continental empire. Nationalism was to become the new dynamic principle that replaced the Middle Ages' failed dream of universality. The question is now whether that principle has run its course, and whether out of the muddle of our times, some new organizing principle, still invisible to us, may be struggling to be born. Is there any clue for us in the years that followed the sad 14th? Unhappily, the experience of the 15th for 3/4 of the way was, if anything, worse. Wolves appeared in the outskirts of Paris during a recurrence of the plague. The bitter night howl of François Villon was the era's voice, and the danse macabre, or dance of death, its symbol. France was leaderless under a mad king, while rival regents took to mutual assassination. England was torn apart in the Civil War of the Roses. The infidel Turk was hammering at the gates of Europe. The papacy, for a while, was ridiculously divided among 3 claimants. Yet art flourished and intellectual renaissance opened the mind. The nationalism that flared in Joan of Arc and brought France back to her feet spread its energies into the European stream. Mysteriously, in the 4th quarter of the century, recovery began, leading to economic revival, effective monarchy, opening of the new world, and accumulative crescendo. How and why this happened has its explanations, but I would hesitate to say they apply to us. You may justly complain that I have supplied no answers, and not even answered my own question in the title. Has the historian nothing to offer? I can suggest one other clue. Turn back to the oldest foundations, the Old Testament, and to the strange, prolonged wandering of the people of the Exodus in the wilderness. Why did they take 40 years to cover a distance of 150 miles? The answer is, they were a generation unfit to enter the promised land. They had to die out. It was their children who arrived. Thank you very much.
Author Barbara Tuchman, speaking at the University of California at Berkeley.